erotic perspectives, gravity, sunlight, and unity delusion. Ever since Eve took the apple, the connection between women and desire has been fraught. While we may generally feel, as modern minds, that we inhabit a post-industrial, post-religious Western world, we are in fact living squarely in its aftermath. Our social infrastructure, both physical and non-visible, still stands to hold up ideas of the past. A woman split away from her desire is a woman separated from her body. But we all share the aftermath, no matter our gender, and are all heirs to its negative impact. Even the person who thinks they don't care about the philosophy of desire has doctrines and guiding principles they practice nonetheless. Lack of conscious consideration of one's own desire only creates a vacancy for another's desire. What I mean is that if a person, especially a woman, does not reclaim their own desire, it will be claimed by a larger desiring body, making them a prop for another's will, be that capitalism, the patriarchal perspectives, or the limitations of familial and cultural frameworks. To desire in our culture is to be caught in the riptide of our own wanting and the cross current of guilt. We are collectively confused and consumed by mixed messages, which result in misguided attempts at relief and fulfillment, most of which occur without deeper inquiry. We hardly or never turn back to analyze the very phenomena that propels us. After years throttling the extremes of nihilism, asceticism, and devout consumerism, I've ended up with an evolving set of theories and practices in regards to desire. Experiments facilitated through writing, a meditation practice, reading philosophy and psychoanalysis, and through varying degrees of failure at fulfillment. This incomplete auto-theoretic foray will draw from a few sources, which I have shared in the footnotes below. But mostly, this is guided by what Goethe terms the tender empiricism of my own sensate body negotiating degrees of pain and pleasure. 1. The maintenance of longing. In Desire and Matter, an Erotic Ecology, Andreas Weber establishes the term eros, or desire, which he uses synonymously, as the foundational driving force of all living matter. For Weber, it is desire that motivates creation. All of life pushing, reaching forward to expand, be it a virus, a beanstalk, or a human driven to love. The erotic is the genuine principle of life that permeates the world of bodies and life forms, he quotes. Weber does away with the long-standing Darwinian concept of the natural world as survival of the fittest and replaces it with an understanding of ecological reality as a complex relational system. This ecological reality contains seemingly conflicting ends. Matter that is propelled by desire towards the impossibility of fulfillment. The death contained in all life. The surplus and destruction that abound in nature, making the core of our reality the core of matter, a paradox in physical terms. However, life does not wish to resolve this paradox. It, quote, transforms lack into an excess that produces new contradictions. The way we characterize or understand these foundations of life has a drastic influence on the way we live, attend, and consume. If we can entertain the idea that the foundational forces of life are incongruent and that they actually require the tension of opposites to create more life, what happens to our need for control and resolution? how do we direct the allotment of our own personal desire, that is, our own force, into creating new complications? If we can seek to maintain our longing instead of seeking relief from it, we have a very different project at hand. In the essay Forms of Desire in Poetic Attention by Lucy Alford, she relays, in desire, the relation is more dominantly characterized by distance, by not having. For both of these writers, the phenomena of desire is in the reaching, the longing. It is a lack of and not an attaining of. The felt experience of desire is the embodiment of that longing. The discomfort generated by longing propels an individual to act, to create. She continues, both love and desire require an interval of distance and difference between subject and object. But in desire, the interval is widened, more tensely felt, sharpened by frustration. We move towards what Mary Wilde calls the limits of satisfaction and the yearning for the impossible. Quoted from her podcast in which she explores Jacques Lacan's Object Petit A. She expounds further to say, because achievement of this aim is impossible, we substitute fantasies, sexual, romantic, narcissistic, or material accomplishment, and we convince ourselves that we will be satisfied in realizing them. End quote. 2. The gravity of longing. If eros at its core is a drive to live, to expand, to reach, it is through that drive that we encounter, we touch. And it is through encountering others that we simultaneously define our own edges. We individuate in relationship, which is in itself a beautiful paradox. Not only are we defined by the encounter with other, the world is affected by the way we encounter it. In physics, this is referred to as the observer effect. In Buddhist philosophy, it is called dependent origination. The quality of our touch, which is another way of saying our attention, shapes the world and ourselves concurrently. Let's expand on touch as a form of attention. We reach towards not just with our fingers, but our eyes, our hearts, and our minds. And we are touched not just by hands, but by all we encounter through all of our senses. The wind, emotional currents of pain and pleasure, words on a page. In the West, we come to think we have 5 physical senses, but in the East, it is seen to be 6 or more, including the mind as a sensual organ. So even the way we think can be a way of touching the world. And to expand our definition of touch is to expand the space for desire to exist and function. One of the most moving passages from Weber's chapter on touch is an observation of a river and how the elements of stone and water encounter each other and in so doing are transformed. Quote, by coming into contact with the water, the stone's form softens, and through that softening, it begins to show characteristics that are in fundamental opposition to itself. End quote. It struck me as so beautiful how willing nature is to bend its form and respond to its environment. How selfless that is. All of life on this planet is initiated or enabled by the light received from the sun. Light being another form of touch that reaches across space to feel the Earth's surface. It is our exact proximity to ultraviolet light and the possession of carbon that predisposes life. It is not an abstraction, a thunderous or benevolent God, but simply light which photosynthesizes on the open palm of a leaf and makes this planet edible and habitable. The plant translates the world into body and thereby reveals further dimensions of the world that had been previously invisible. The association of translation as light becoming fluent in matter, the body of plants, squarely hits my philosophical G-spot. If we can see all of life as the embodied yearning towards touch, and we can widen that sense beyond the personal to societal and to the natural world, we can experience what Weber calls gravitation as the Earth's tender longing for us. Through this lens, we can come into relationality with the world. We loosen the projects of personal satisfaction, personal desire, pain, and even love to be broader and more robust. He quotes, "Hadn't we all become obsessed with an image of love that has led us away from aliveness and sucked us down into a spiral of desire in whose middle is nothing but our own optimized self?" End quote. And what a more robust definition of love Weber offers us. Love, not as a kitschy feeling, but as an unbridled force with which creative energy molds the world into individuals and then destroys them. End quote. Jiddu Krishnamurti says, "The ability to observe without evaluating is the highest form of intelligence." Can we go a step further and call that brand of intelligence love? Because from the acceptance of non-unity and the consent to complexity and the suffering it bears, love includes what is ugly and what is difficult, not as encounters that need remedy or resolve, but as inclusions of love itself. Love simply becomes a way of looking at what is difficult without interrupting the process of transformation. Perhaps we too soon reach away from and not hold on to our own eros, which is our own discomfort. And in so doing, we fail to let our internal world be transformed by the encounter of our own force. Worse still, we spend that force outwardly in ways that have been predicted on our behalf, reap little reward, or actually increase our deficit. Or, on the other end of the spectrum, we collapse into self-pity and apathy, not even fully inhabiting our own desire before it is thrown away, again throttling the extremes between self-abandonment and self-gratification, both shots fired in the direction of aliveness, and both not only miss but diminish the electrical bandwidth available to the human body. A body experienced as the individual expression of universal desire. And paradoxically, in order to become more alive, we must die over and over. 3. The little death. By definition, the act of sex or any desire enacted is the quelling or the annihilation of eros. There is a reason that in French an orgasm is referred to as la petite mort, the little death. Consummation is the death of desire, and an important one. Desire can be consummated in many ways. It is the point of purchase, the midnight text, teeth sinking through a chocolate bar. It is the release of the build-up created by longing, one we all seek and very much need. While there is no end to the build-up of desire, or any one act will not stop desire from again rising in the body, there are varying degrees of fulfillment available when it comes to consummating that desire. One of my teachers who focuses on Eros Dharma has a simple exercise of asking oneself what the reward will be when you attain the object of. Example, if I get X, I will get to feel X. It doesn't take many rounds of this practice to get closer to the source of desire. And this could be the point at which one decides not to act upon the desire, or it could be the place where we clarify the innermost part of our wanting and act on something more essential and unique to us. Because while wanting grows and accumulates in all bodies in the same way, it moves towards different ends. It is infinitely complex and varied as the forms it inhabits. This is how desire draws a line and so connects the inner and outer world. A loop from the universal emergence of matter to an individualized expression and back into the universal meaning of symbols. Confirming the common adage, what is most personal is most universal. This all sounds like a nice clean little graph, but the rubber hits the road when we have to face off with the motivating forces behind most of our habitual desires and grasping. Most of the time we are motivated by a few core desires. It is easy to go on acting on their behalf in more and more abstract ways without ever actually tending to them directly. Facing off with our core motivating desires requires a capacity for grief. It means reckoning with the part of ourselves that didn't get their needs met at one point in time and at that time decided on a strategy, an abstract path of gratification instead of feeling the primary pain. 4. Unity delusion. We have a culture that promises to deliver us from our own eros through various ends. One of the most culturally condoned ways we have been conditioned to believe in deliverance is through romantic love. We have killed all of the gods except for Aphrodite and placed unfathomable pressure on ourselves and our partners to be the one, which is essentially the deification of a human beyond what they are capable of. One of the most toxic myths in our culture is the Greek myth of soulmates, in which the world was once occupied by complete human beings with four legs, four arms, and two heads who were perfectly happy. Zeus split them all in half and they were doomed to walk the earth looking for completeness in another person, their other half. Every time I hear this story, it angers me. It's a poetic tale, I admit, but it completely discounts the various ways that people become more whole, that mostly in my experience happen outside of the strict romantic conditions this demands, be it alone in the dark or in the light of the blank page, amongst old friends or strangers. The belief in unity acquired through another creates a lack of individual autonomy and or delusions of grandeur. Perhaps one of the most dangerous aspects of unity delusion is the objectification of others, which is to flatten a person into a tool, a key that suits the size and contour of our own desire, unlocking a body from its discomfort. In other words, if we believe in the possibility of being completed or even just fulfilled, we start looking over our shoulder for a means to that end. We can look to porn to see this played out most crudely. Susan Sontag says, "Pornography is a theater of types, never of individuals." Types can also be seen as objects. Objects like hammers or candy jars, which are involved in a kind of mutual extraction. I will defend every person's right to be objectified, if, when, and how they choose to be. However, there must be at the heart of the objectified act an awareness of the stage. The individual's role is both director and actor. If there is no awareness of the stage, the act is being directed by the unseen forces, intentions, or desires of another. From this perspective of unity delusion, an individual can only optimize themselves, become a more perfected social object in order to ascertain a desirable counter object that will function to fill their lack. Counterintuitively, the result of consenting to being in perpetual uncertainty without grabbing towards unity is not disillusionment. Disillusionment is more likely to occur when the failed attempts at unity pile up. The belief in the possibility of unity is unaccepting of failure. When we fall at the feet of unfathomable uncertainty, the unrequited embodiment of desire, the paradox at the core of reality, the response is something akin to awe. Quote, "In the end, the only response to this incomprehensible phenomena of a desire that abides as desire is to echo it. Language becomes an instrument not of analysis, but of serene acceptance." End quote.